On this edition of Cowboys on the Commons, we first talk to Anthony Rogers Wright, policy coordinator for the Climate Justice Alliance, about the mainstream silencing of the fundamentals of the climate debate. And then we follow up with Michael Albert, participatory economics advocate and host of the Revolution Z podcast, about joining Democratic Socialists of America and creating real workplace democracy. If you like this content and want to keep it coming for free, please support us at patreon.com/solidarityhouse. Anthony, can you hear me?
I can. How are you, Matt? Oh, no, my pleasure. My pleasure. Great to talk to you.
Yeah. So you're in Nebraska, and I noticed that you had been meeting with some elected officials and stuff there. Is this for the purpose of promoting some climate justice in the heartland? Since I'm in Wyoming, maybe you can...
Always. Climate justice in the heartland, in the Gulf South, in the Pacific Northwest, everywhere. Quite frankly, the people here in Nebraska are very into environmental stewardship, more than I think people give them credit for, keeping in mind that this was ground zero for the Keystone XL pipeline that brought together, you know, an alliance of, you know, settlers and indigenous people to fight that pipeline and who are still fighting that pipeline. But the area that I've been specifically working in is with helping farmers transform the agroecology and regenerative ag. And that's actually been receiving an amazing reception just because of the perilous situation that many farmers find themselves in, whether it's the, you know, the climate crisis or the rising economic inequality and, the rising capitalism that's being interjected into the entire agricultural market and way of doing things. A lot of these small family farms, the Winnebago tribe, who we also work with, have been extremely receptive to, getting government incentives and assistance in helping these farmers get out of the industrial ag model. I spoke at the Nebraska Farmer Union annual conference last year with my friend Graham Christensen, who I run this group Regenerate Nebraska with. And Professor Skolsky, I think her name was, she's a professor at UNL, mm-hmm. who actually wrote the Midwest portion of the governmental report on climate change that, you know, Trump tried to, jettison and keep away from the people, you know, quarantine, so to speak. And you should have seen the faces of, grown white men, you know, probably never taken an anti-patriarchy course in their life, but... I mean, just the looks on their faces. I joked around with Graham that, like, their faces got whiter when she started, like, breaking down, like, you know, the consequences of this crisis, what it's going to be doing to their farms and their ways of life. So, I mean, I think that these farmers, especially after this year, are all of, you know, you're not going to find too many climate deniers, you know, but that, you know, that's not necessarily how we get in the door all the time with them by, you know, bringing up the climate crisis immediately. But, you know, they get it, though. You know, they understand that there's changes to weather patterns, and those changes obviously have direct impacts on, you know, their bottom line. So
I want to say that there was a certain strain of frustration on your part that inspired me to want to talk to you today in the wake of the climate town hall and everything else that's going on. And before we get to that, I want to ask in general, who are the groups that the rest of us should be following and listening to chiefly regarding political strategies, mass action? Yep. The demands of a just climate transition, regardless of what it's called, red, green, or otherwise, New Deal.
Right, right. So certainly, you know, I'm honored to be the policy coordinator with the Climate Justice Alliance. Not everything that I'll say in this interview reflects, you know, them directly and what, you know, their views directly. But the Climate Justice Alliance, we're, of course, have 70 members and growing from across the country and the world, quite frankly. We have members in Puerto Rico and Guam, you know, and then of course some in Indian country. So our members, including the Indigenous Environmental Network, should certainly be looked to and tapped for their amazing work and wisdom that they've been doing for, quite frankly, so long. Just Transition Alliance, out that's Jose Bravo's group, Jose was one of the people who, you know, came up with the concept of Just Transition in a coalition with other amazing people as well. So, you know, I've been doing this for 20 years and whatnot. So, yeah, I you know, all of our members, that's just like a snapshot of our members. You know, in New York City, we, of course, have the New York City Environmental Justice Alliance and the mighty Uprose Brooklyn, led by Eddie Bautista and Elizabeth Yampierre, respectively. And they, of course, were a part of the New York Renews Coalition. They led the New York Renews Coalition along with our allies, Push Buffalo, another amazing group. And of course, the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act that was signed into law in New York is being heralded as the most aggressive climate policy at the state level in the world.
Right.
And there's still more work to do on it. Right. So these are the groups that have been doing this, you know, longer. You know, we like to say that, you know, we've been calling it climate justice and just transition for years. People want to call it Green New Deal now, fine. But I mean, from our perspective, it's always been climate justice and environmental justice, just transition, indigenous sovereignty, and intergenerational fight. You know, all these concepts that are. You know, we're not trying to be like those hipsters who like wear the T-shirts that said like everything you liked, I liked when it was cool, or anything like that. But it's important that we also.
No, it's just true in this case.
Right. Yeah, that's true. Right. But it's important that we are consistent with our narrative and accurate with our narrative, because narrative has so much power. And, you know, the bottom line is that the principles of environmental justice, which came about from a people of color forum at Riverside Church in 1991, have many of the concepts that are now being applied to various variations of Green New Deal. And it's just, you know, important that this wisdom and this knowledge is upheld and respected and given its due, because the people who founded the EJ and climate justice movement, our elders, you know, sacrificed a lot, some of them even their lives, to really get us, I think, to the point that we're at right now. Mm-hmm.
Taking kind of the frustration with electoral politics and corporate politics as a given, talk about your frustration, your unique frustration with what was missed and sacrificed and in terms of the CNN forum, and I just think
sure.
the corporate coverage of the primaries and the climate question in general.
I really appreciate that question. I think it's really important that, you know, first and foremost, I do believe that Tom Perez acted languorously and myopically, quite frankly, when referring to climate change as a single issue. And using that sort of as an argument to eventually vote down a proper debate on this quintessential crisis that, of course, is not a single issue, but, you know, involves our economy, involves how we treat each other, involves social justice, justice for women, justice for immigrants, justice, of course, for indigenous people. So, I mean, first and foremost, I just think that was a big error on the part of the Democrats. I'm in the DNC, and just an abortion, quite frankly, of leadership altogether. Mm-hmm. But the format of the town hall that CNN did, yes, like you said, very corporate, did not center frontline communities. The majority of the questions came and or were derived either by white people or people representing majority white, historically white-led environmental groups. And that's very problematic. Because, you know, it goes back to like sort of black liberation dogma, if you will, or paradigm that like in order to uplift everyone, we have to uplift the most oppressed. And we know that the people who are most oppressed by the climate crisis, of course, are black, brown, indigenous people and women. But it's not just that, right? We also, by CNN not really centering the front lines, they also neglected the public to learn about the real solutions that are coming from these communities, like just transition, energy democracy, and food sovereignty, you know, and also not tying in other sectoral, other sectors that need to be considered, including housing, education, and of course, mass incarceration, militarism, and militarization of the police. So by not centering the front lines, it was not an informative, it was not a very informative town hall. And by not allowing us to see how these candidates defend their approaches, right, in real time with each other, also neglected the public from being able to, you know, make a really informed decision. And, you know, people can, of course, do their own independent research, but the point of these debates, the point of these forums are to inform us to
so that people can make an informed decision to make, you know, a vote for. We hear it all the time, and it's hyperbolic, but not this time. This election is quintessential. It matters. The outcome of this election is going to determine myriad aspects of how we're going to approach this crisis efficaciously or not at all. So, yeah, for starters, that's what sort of got my Irish up and fueled my chagrin.
I'm afraid, or maybe I'm oversimplifying, but it feels to me like the right side of the Democratic primary debate is if they devote any time to the climate issue, it is through a managerial lens and a very white bourgeois capitalist managerial lens. And I see hope in obviously the approach that Bernie is taking. Did anything else come out of the forum, or is anything else coming out of that political dynamic that pleasantly surprises you or encourages you?
Well, I mean, you know, we're of course extremely happy with what Bernie put out for his climate platform, calling it Green New Deal. We appreciate that it explicitly rejects the use of false solutions like geoengineering, carbon offsets, carbon markets to address this crisis. So that, I mean, you know, he stands alone right now with that. And of course, previously we were very impressed and pleased with many of the bold proposals that Jay Inslee put forward in his climate platform, which we did believe at the time. It still is a standard for presidential climate platforms. What did surprise me was that, like, there were a lot of candidates who were non-committal to things like a national fracking ban. I just don't understand how, you know, you can call yourself an ardent climate champion if you cannot call for the outright ban on such an extractive practice that uses profligate amounts of water, pollutes the air with a gas that is 80 times more heat trapping than carbon dioxide in the short term, and of course the social impacts that it's having on sovereignty of indigenous land and proximity specifically to Black and Latinx students whose schools are being placed right next to these harmful operations. So that threw me for a loop a bit, and obviously that's unfortunate. But
How about Elizabeth Warren? What do you have to say about the Warren campaign and the general orientation of the most progressive forces in this conversation, where they stand with the Warren campaign?
Yeah, I think that Elizabeth Warren continues to pique the interest of a lot of people, myself included. You know, it does seem like she is trying to thread, you know, a needle of sort of right with Bush. Mm-hmm. It was compassionate conservatism, and with Warren, it seems to be some form of compassionate capitalism, so to speak. You know, her climate platform is obviously. You know, there are aspects of it that could certainly be improved, but it is certainly more on the progressive wing of, you know, of the platforms that have come out. It's good to see that she is in communication with Governor Inslee and has, you know, incorporated parts of his plan into her overall package. And, you know, there's still so much more to learn. I mean, I think that Elizabeth Warren also seems to be a bit more comfortable than Bernie in some cases with talking about race-specific plans, right? Plans that specifically will target marginalized Black people, marginalized Black women as it pertains to, you know, dying during childbirth, mortality during birth, giving birth, and things of that nature. So, she remains very, very intriguing. I'm glad that she's in the race. You know, I think she brings a very important voice to the debate, and we're gonna have to wait and see how things unfold. I you know, it's not for me to say, but I think that if I was advising her, I would probably do a bit more to heal some of the wounds that she caused with indigenous people. And you know, I don't know what that looks like, and it's not my place to say what it does and doesn't look like. But I do, in some of the interactions that I've had with indigenous people who I look to for wisdom and for ideas and for support, you know, some have indicated to me that, you know, her actions in that case still wounded some people and hurt some people, and that some healing needs to be done. So,
What sort would that also be the center or the starting point for any critical coaching if you were doing that, if you were advising the Sanders campaign in terms of maybe Bernie's continuing efforts to be a candidate that that truly reaches out to and connects with indigenous communities, communities of color.
There's no one that can argue that Bernie's policies are extremely bold, and that he, in many ways, has already done his job with the idea that he's put into the national lexicon regarding healthcare, climate change, economics, income inequality, systems that don't work for the many but for the few, and then, you know, even with racial justice. I think that what I would do is, you know, yeah, Cardi B is great, Killer Mike is great, but they're not the grassroots, and they don't even necessarily represent, you know, Black communities. And you know, we really do need to talk about Black people specifically and not people of color. Not that there's anything wrong with talking about people
sure.
of color, but in the context of securing the Democratic nomination, okay, we have to talk about the Black vote specifically. And I would, you know, just all candidates, quite frankly, but as a top tier front runner, Bernie Sanders also has an incumbent responsibility, I think, quite frankly, to really invest more in the grassroots organizing elements of reaching the Black community. As amazing and brilliant as the Nina Turners and the Cornel Wests, you know, of the world are, we could certainly use more of them. You know, they aren't necessarily vanguards for Black communities, right? And this is where, you know, some people get mad at Warren for doing this. I think it's pragmatic and I think it's strategic that, yes, she is reaching out to some establishment leaders. It hasn't seemed to change her stance, but Bernie also will have to reach out to some people who I don't necessarily believe are always have the best interests of Black people in their minds. You know, Black Democrats, Congressional Black Caucus. That said, Bernie Sanders does have to develop a relationship with these folks who are representing constituents, right, who right now tend to be behind Biden for whatever reason. And I don't understand that myself necessarily as an African-American. Mm-hmm. But I mean, just in general, like, go into the heart of it, Bernie. You know, I mean, you know, Danny Glover is amazing. All the people I named prior are amazing. But the people who are voting, the way you create relationships with them is through some serious grassroots organizing, and that's localized, right? So you gotta, you know, you want to win California, you need to be speaking with local Black organizers in the Bay Area, in you know, the Valley, and in Los Angeles, right? Like, you know, who are the grassroots local organizers that you need to speak to? There's BLM, for instance. BLM LA is one of the bigger chapters. Same goes with Houston. There's people like Candace Weber in Houston who leads BLM Houston. She is local grassroots, and she needs to be, you know, reached out to, and not sending a Turner in there, but you need to go speak with her yourself. And Anoa Changa, for instance, in Atlanta, Georgia, you know, another example of a local respected grassroots organizer who knows her community, the trends in her community, the changes, what the community needs specifically, right? And that's that would be my recommendation.
What can our listeners do to support your work? How can our listeners make your life easier?
You know, certainly donating to grassroots, frontline community-based building organizations. There's Climate Justice Alliance, Indigenous Environmental Network, Kentuckians for the Commonwealth, Right to the City, the Florida Farm Workers Association. All of these groups, you know, are doing amazing work on shoestring budgets, because we do have an income inequality problem in the way that environmental groups are funded, right? Historically white-led groups are getting close to 90% of the funding, and frontline, smaller, less funded groups are, you know, fighting keep doing the amazing work that they have already been doing with a limited funding. So, first and foremost that. And then, you know, just really digging deeper. I think it's important for people who are ardent climate champions to dig deeper and not just sort of centralize this discussion with, you know, three or four thought leaders or authors, you know, and whatnot. And as much as they've contributed and as great as they are not the environmental movement. and they are certainly not the climate justice movement, right? They don't speak for frontline communities, and I don't think that these thought leaders or particular authors would argue with that. So dig deeper and learn like the full narrative of like the work that is being done and the work that has been done by these communities for years.
Anthony Rogers Wright, safe travels and
thank you.
And get some rest. And,
oh, yeah.
And again, thank you so much for taking a few minutes for us from what is really just, it sounds like great work. I live in Wyoming, so I know the importance of reaching these rural communities and these farming communities. And I just think that it's fantastic the work you're doing.
I really appreciate the time. Thanks for letting me speak, and thanks for the great discussion.
All right, we'll talk to you soon, my friend.
Okay, take care.
Don't cross the line. Don't cross the line. Don't cross the line. Don't cross the line. When you see the sign on a picket line saying this place is unfair, just pass it by like a real smart guy, 'cause the stuff is just as good elsewhere.
Cross the line. Don't cross the line.
When you see the sign on a picket line saying please don't patronize, just be aware that the men out there aren't walking for the exercise.
Cross the line. Don't cross the line.
When you see a place where the pickets face, let those pickets be your guide.
Your guide.
Just don't be chumps. Act as though the mumps was the only thing for sale inside.
Don't cross the line. Don't cross the line. Don't cross the line.
Why DSA? Why now? I think what, as a longtime veteran activist yourself, what interests you about the growth of DSA now?
Well, it's phenomenal. That is to say, the growth, I don't know what it was 4 or 5 years ago, but I would imagine a few thousand.
It was 5,000. It was about 5,000 before, okay, prior to the election. Yeah.
So it's gone up by a factor of 10. That's obviously remarkable. It owes greatly, clearly, to Bernie Sanders and his using the label Democratic Socialist, but it also owes to DSA. That is to say, when people started to look around and to think to themselves, well, what am I going to join? DSA had attributes that caused lots and lots and lots of people to join. I think those attributes owe to a long history. They include that it's non-sectarian, that it's not vanguardist, that it addresses not only economics, but culture and gender and basically all sides of life. So these attributes are very important, and its growth is very important. And so it attracted me. For a long, long time, the left has oriented its way of speaking, has spoken, sort of dismissing by omission working people and working people's daily lives and their daily circumstances. So what has to happen is basically the opposite of that, at least if a left is going to win real change, socialism, etc. It has to appeal to the 80% of the population who are excluded from empowering work. It's not because they're dumb. It's not because they're incapable. It's because society is structured in such a way as to give a monopoly over that work to a smaller portion of the population, about 20% of it. So you have to, what is necessary, both ethically and strategically, is to incorporate that 80% or lots of that 80% into movement activism to win a better society. And then as far as the 20% is concerned, well, for them, it's a little bit more difficult. That is to say, at least the question they confront is a little bit more difficult. Are they willing to give up some advantage? Are they willing to give up a degree of monopolization of empowering work in order to be in a society that is equitable, that's just, that is not exploitative? They have much to gain also, control over their own circumstances, instead of being subordinate to an owner, instead of being subordinate to the rich and the really powerful, the more powerful.
Mm-hmm.
but a movement that basically tries to elevate that 20% while getting rid of the 2% owners, right, is not a movement that's seeking classlessness. It's a movement that's seeking a new boss in place of the old boss.
And while I think that this is done imperfectly, one of the things that impresses me about DSA meetings that I attend is the sort of proactive effort to create non-hierarchical meeting structures and non-hierarchical decision-making structures. And you can tell that people really feel like that's important. And I think to see that effort, I think, is a big difference for me from other experiences that I've had on the left. And it also makes me think that your message to them about maybe incorporating or examining the incorporation of some of these participatory practices into their platforms and their ways of thinking. Well, why don't you talk a little bit about what you hope people get out of the letter?
Yeah, well, I mean, I feel the same as you do. I feel that impetus and that desire is there for a great many people in DSA, maybe for an overwhelming majority of DSA. And so I hope that the letter appeals in that sense and is seen as a constructive attempt to be helpful, to be useful, to provide something in accord with what they're seeking. The question that the letter raises basically is, if you want these things in value terms, you want non-hierarchy, you want classlessness, you want people to control their own lives. Okay, what institutions is it necessary to be for? Is it necessary to advocate? Don't we have to go a little bit beyond the values? I mean, Bill Clinton could get up and give a speech about everybody participating, and he could do it better than most people on the left, actually. He didn't mean it. It didn't have any real basis. Why not? Because the institutions that Bill Clinton supported, right, private ownership, bureaucratic political structures, the Democratic Party in the form that it was, and so on and so forth, those institutions put the lie to his rhetoric. The rhetoric was appealing to many, or Barack Obama. The rhetoric was appealing to many, but the actual real support that they gave to institutions put the lie to it. Mm-hmm. All right. Sometimes the left does that by mistake or by accident or by omission. It's in order to be truly believable to a wide audience in society that we want them to be able to control their own lives, that we want them to be able to have equitable circumstances, that we want them to have solidarity and to have a real sense of community and on, to be believable in expressing those sentiments. I think we need to support institutions which are consistent with those sentiments, which would propel and produce those outcomes. And so the letter has the purpose of saying, maybe we need to go a little further in our definition of what socialism is to make our desires evident and believable.
So you don't think...
To inform our own practice. So... For example, how do we organize an organization like DSA? Forget the whole society. How do we organize our own organization so it's consistent with our goals, with our aims? What do we have to do internally for decision making? Or what do we have to do internally vis-a-vis circumstances and the distribution of tasks and things like that? And what the letter is doing is trying to suggest that this new DSA, this new left that's emerging, has to do better than the one I was part of. Mm-hmm. The one I was part of did have the rhetoric. We did talk about people controlling their own lives. And we did mean it, but we didn't attach ourselves to institutional, not a giant blueprint, but basic structures that were consistent with our rhetoric and with our intentions. We didn't do that. And so we formed movements and organizations which ultimately did not attract and did not retain working people. And I think it's essential to have discussions to try and overcome that past problem and do better.
You don't think that simply saying that workplaces should be organized democratically is enough?
No, because Here's an example. We say that society should be organized democratically. Not only that, we have elections, and it's one person, one vote. But most people in DSA and most people on the left know that something's wrong. Someplace, something is really wrong with that political democracy. So it's partly the gigantic wealth and power in the hands of corporate heads and corporate institutions and their power to influence and to determine the election. But it's also partly that half the population doesn't vote. So now go over to the workplace and imagine that we have a constitution that says the workplace is under the control of the workers. Well, the old Soviet Union had that constitution. So did the old Yugoslavia. But it didn't mean anything. Why not? Because the institution, the organization of the workplace, and the organization of allocation was such that even with the nominal right, there was no reality of participation. There was no reality of democratic control. If a few people have all the information and have all the access to the levers of daily power, then the fact that you say we're going to have a big meeting for everybody to decide doesn't mean everybody's going to decide. Those few people are going to come to the meeting prepared, confident, energetic. The rest are going to come to the meeting beaten down, exhausted, lacking information.
Doesn't this just cut to the point that the joke that the problem with socialism is that there's too many meetings?
No, because the problem isn't too many meetings, although too many meetings is a problem if you are stupid enough to have too many meetings. The problem is, in my opinion, but it should be discussed and figured out. I'm not saying to DSA, okay, come to my viewpoint because it's right. I'm saying there are issues to discuss, very important issues to discuss. So I think that, for example, the problem here isn't the number of meetings. It's the organization of the workplace. It's the corporate division of labor, which takes 20% of the workforce and empowers it, and 80% of the workforce and disempowers it. 20% of the workforce has confidence and information and contacts and access to circumstances conducive to participating and making decisions. 80% has the exact opposite of that. It is robbed of skills. It is robbed of information. It is isolated from one another. It is fragmented. And so even in workplaces that have an assembly, a workers' council, where it's one person, one vote, it doesn't mean that it's going to in fact be democratic, much less self-managing. Why? Because the 80% sit there and have to listen to the 20% deliver the agenda and have to listen to the 20% provide the arguments, which are often suited to the interests of the 20%, not the 80%. And the 80% get sick of that. And pretty soon they're not voting. They're not voting in the national election. 50% don't vote. They're not voting in a workplace. Pretty much all 80% won't attend after a while, because who wants to attend a meeting which is described as democratic, in which a set of people who earn way more and who have way more power, who have a different culture and a different way of interacting, who are all connected to one another and disconnected from us, 80%, are making the decisions. And meanwhile, as a result, our incomes are going down and theirs are going up. Our influence is going down and theirs is going up. So to avoid that class conflict, because that's what it is. And it was that in the old Soviet Union, in the old model of in 20th century socialism, in centrally planned socialism, in market socialism. I wouldn't call any of them socialism. I would call them coordinatorism. But that's a different issue. But the point is, in those economies, the choice of institutions, despite the better intentions of a great many people, right, cause bad outcomes. In the old revolutions, most of the participants wanted democracy. They wanted freedom. They even wanted self-management. They wanted equity. They wanted justice. There were only a relatively small number who saw the process as something that would elevate them and screw the rest, right? That wasn't most people. Okay, so that can happen again. So what we need to do is to not only have great sentiments, great values, great desires, but to have at least the core commitments to some key defining institutions that give substance to all that, that give truth to all that. That's what we need. And the letter is just basically saying, admittedly a bit long-windedly, basically saying, here are some things that I think are worth discussing in order to try to achieve that fundamentally new and exemplary goal. That is, that an organization seeking a new society really does favor institutions and processes that incorporate working people, that incorporate people who are oppressed along other criteria, gender, race, political authority, that incorporate all of that on a fair and equal basis so there's real self-management. That's the goal of the letter.
What does a participatory allocation planning session look like? Can you try to describe it even in the most general terms? Sure.
Yeah. First of all, what is it? It's the process by which an economy, meaning the workers and the consumers in the economy, arrive at intentions, arrive at a set of norms, a set of aims for how much to produce, for what to produce, for how much to consume, for how to consume, and so on. It's called allocation. In our economy, it's done by a market and by central planning, because there is central planning inside huge institutions like General Motors. So it's done by a combination of markets and planning. I think markets and planning are both horrendous institutions. One is intensely authoritarian, central planning, and the other is conducive to grotesque competition, fragmentation, ecological disaster, injustice, and on and on and on. Okay, so what's the alternative to all that? Well, if there's no alternative, we're in deep trouble. And that's what most people tell us, including most people on the left. But maybe there is an alternative. So I think there is. I think we can call it participatory planning, or whatever else you want to call it. And it's a process whereby workers in their councils, in their workplaces, and in their federations of councils, a whole industry, and consumers as individuals and in neighborhoods and in larger units like counties or states, essentially cooperatively negotiate inputs and outputs using prices, using indicators of the social costs and benefits of a particular item and its production and its consumption. Using that, they propose what they want to do, and they get feedback as to the reactions to the proposal, and they refine the proposal. And this goes on through a series of what an economist would call iteration, rounds of interaction, to arrive at a shared plan. And then people implement that plan, which is to say workers produce the materials that are planned for their bicycle factory or violin factory or whatever it might be. And consumers consume, get the stuff that they want. And along the course of a year, there are alterations and refinements and updating, and there's means to do that. But the key point is the participants in this are, there's no center, there is no top, there is no boss. The participants in this are workers and consumers, and workers and consumers' councils, because of collective consumption and collective production. And each is participating in it with essentially exactly the same interests: to produce material of social worth, to consume material that's desired and makes one life better, and to accommodate that production and consumption together. Nobody gains a great tremendous wealth or profit or anything. It doesn't exist, right? Income is fair and equitable across everybody, and so on. That's if we can agree on sensibly formulated and that prove valid institutions to accomplish those ends. And that's what the letter is about. Not coming up with a blueprint for the future. Most future determinations are for future people to decide as they see fit. But the point is, there's a few institutions which, if you have them, preclude future people from deciding their own future. So, for instance, if somebody says, I want the future people to self-manage their own circumstances cooperatively, and I favor private ownership of the means of production. Well, the person's lying, because private ownership of the means of production precludes future people, except for the private owners, having a fair say in what's going to happen and being able to determine their own lives. If somebody has an alternative set of institutions which are consistent with that, then they're providing the basis for future people making those decisions. That's the level of vision we need. The level of vision we need is precisely that minimum set of institutions that are critical to future people being in a position to decide their own lives. And participatory planning is one of those institutions. I think maybe somebody else will think something else. Maybe DSA can arrive at shared agreement about what those relative few institutions, and I suspect it's only about four, few institutions need to be to ensure that the future is what we want, instead of getting some god-awful thing that we don't want, like, say, Stalinism or various other historical outcomes that most of the people who suffered them were seeking to avoid. There are co-ops all over the place, cooperatives. Many of them are worker-owned. So if you take a worker-owned cooperative and you then additionally diminish and ultimately eliminate the hierarchy between empowered workers and disempowered workers by basically empowering everyone so that you've simply eliminated the difference, then you're getting very close. If you then add on that that institution begins to interact with other institutions in a cooperative and negotiating way instead of by the market or central planning, then you're getting really close. Now, that's very hard to do without making very major changes. But instances of units which behave collectively and cooperatively and without hierarchy do exist, ranging from families and larger families to workplaces that go beyond being cooperative to being participatory. Historically, you know, the Spanish Revolution, wiped out by fascism and also Stalinism, and then suffering the ills of World War II, but that experiment was massive. And was very promising, and did incorporate a good deal, at least, of what I think, say, DSA would decide if it has this exploration collectively is necessary to achieve real classlessness, real self-management.
You have not always, and I know you and Robin have not always been comfortable with the term socialism, and I know that in your life it has maybe had different manifestations of that, but maybe everyone's using it now. Do you feel any kind of discomfort with the word and yeah. with the sort of ambiguous meaning of the word?
Well, I think the ambiguousness is a problem, ultimately, and it's a problem because if socialism comes to mean just more government intervention, not a bad thing in the world we live in, right? A left, humane government intervention is needed. But if that's all it means, if it comes to mean markets and central planning and the old cooperative, you know, corporate division of labor, then the best that you're going to get, or the worst that you're going to get, depending upon how you look at it, is the old style socialism. And I don't think the old style socialism merits the name. But that's all semantics. If we settle on something, suppose we settle on a vision. Suppose it has participatory planning and it has balanced job complexes, what I call balanced job complexes, to get rid of the corporate division of labor. And it has equitable remuneration. And it has the means and the methods of self-management. And we call those the basic features of something that we call participatory socialism. Well, it's very different from just social democracy. And it's very different from what has been called market socialism and centrally planned socialism. So I think we should call those things market coordinatorism, centrally planned coordinatorism, and social democracy we can call social democracy because it's not using the word socialism. But I think we should call the other thing maybe participatory socialism. And it is different. And to be clear about that matters, because if we popularize the term but don't popularize the new meaning, let's say it that way, if the term socialism becomes even more widespread than it already is, and it's incredibly widespread now, and that's a remarkable accomplishment. But if it becomes even more widespread, but it comes to mean the current system with a nicer president, the current system with a government which is more influenced by unions, say, and working class organization, if it comes to mean Sweden in the old days, well, that's better than what we have now by far, but it's also unstable and can drift right back into what we have now, which is happening in Sweden. If it comes to mean a new system with new norms for income distribution, with new relationships in the workplace, a new division of labor, with new means of making decisions, and with new allocation, well, then that it really is something that would deserve the label socialism, and I would like to call it participatory socialism, just to avoid that conflict or that difficulty.
I was going to remind listeners that you host the Revolution Z Life After Capitalism podcast, and it looks like you're already, 21 episodes in?
Yeah, I think it's 21.
Yeah. It looks like there's a great deal of interest. You can reach that through Z Communications or zcom.org/revolutionz. Also the Revolution Z Patreon page if folks want to support it. So I wanted to give you a shout out for that.
Thank you for that.
Looks like you have some really interesting conversations going on, and we talked about before that you really want to get really down and dirty in those conversations about how it's done.
How we get there and what there is.
If you like this content, please become a supporter of Solidarity House at patreon.com/solidarityhouse. We need your support to continue producing interviews with leading activists and writers, along with news about communes, our original music, and more. That's patreon.com/solidarityhouse.